Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who has an idea that will revolutionise the game of association football. It's Richard Herring!
Oh yeah, hello Mary, hello, hello. Love to see you. Should have killed me last year. Hello! Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Though I was hanging around with Darius from Popstars the other day. It's not even from the X Factor, he's from Popstars. He calls it Relastabus. He's doing okay. He's doing all right. So, Darius, he's doing all right. I was watching football on the TV last night. I don't usually watch football, but I was watching the game. Quite good. The goalkeeper had a beard. Don't usually see that with a goalkeeper, right? And I thought, is there a rule that stops a goalkeeper growing a beard that's the size of the goal and then gelling it up so it's like solid hair? It's a hair wall. Can't be penetrated by a football. Don't think there is a rule that says that. So I am going to become a billionaire because I'm going to start up a football team. Might you not even bother with the other players? I only have to pay one person. I mean, we'll always draw 0-0, but that's... May have one other bloke. Not much else. We went to see Back to the Future, the musical. Yeah? You like it? No, it's great. It's, you know, just watch the film. The film's better, though, isn't it? The film's better. Yeah. You know what I don't like about it? All the songs, isn't it? That's what ruins it for me. there's a bit that my, I went with my kids again, and my, I told a story about my son Matilda making the whole audience laugh. Go and listen to it if you haven't heard it yet. Can't remember what show it's in. But at the beginning, this one, quite early on, Doc Brown says the word crap. And my son turned to my wife and said, "What does crap mean?" It's kind of made everyone laugh again. He's got two, he's been in the theatre twice. He's got more laughs than I have. Very good. It's all right, it's okay. If you like, Back to the Future. Being changed a bit. And they're going to use up all my stand-up in this first episode. That's how it's not going to have any. I've been reading, with my daughter at night, I've been reading a book called Fantastically Great Women Who Made History. It's a nice thing to read with my daughter, although it turns out that nearly all the fantastically great women who made history are dead and died making history. But it's nice. It's nice to give us strong role models. I enjoyed... sometimes I find out stuff I don't know. Most of it, to be honest. Elizabeth Blackwell, I'd never heard of, I don't think, who was the first woman to get a medical degree, possibly, in America. Anyway, she was... She didn't... I mean, she's dead now, but she didn't die in the story. She was an impressive story. But she finally got into a university, off the top of my head, remembering, in Geneva, somewhere like that. The only reason she was allowed to enter the university was because they asked all the men at the university... if they would vote to allow a woman to study medicine with them. And they all just assumed it was a joke. Because that was so ridiculous. And so they voted yes as a joke. And she got in and was top of the hat class. That's the way to do it, girls. So it's good to have a live... One of the women survived as an example. It's nice to have that. For your daughter, isn't it? Nice to say, look, you can do it. So it's kind of embarrassing how awful history is to women when you're going through it with your daughter trying to inspire her. Anyway, my guest this week is probably best known for her appearance on the Antiques Roadshow. That's why we're here. She's mainly known for. Will you please welcome the amazing Emma Dabiri, ladies and gentlemen? Dabiri! Fuck, I did it. I did it wrong. After all that, Dabiri. I knew I would. I knew. We were joking about it backstage about how I got her name right.
Yeah, I was so impressed because he said my name correctly, which is, I'm just not even used to hearing the correct pronunciation. I was like, wow.
And then I said, and I prefer it my way. Yeah. And then it was stuck in my way. Damn. How was the Antiques Roadshow for you? Do you remember being on the Antiques
Roadshow? Fantastic, yeah. What career highlight.
What did you do on the Antiques
Roadshow? I can't remember. You sprung that on me. What were we looking at? I actually can't remember.
Wow. If I was on the Antiques Roadshow, I'd remember all about it.
It was a good few years ago, to be fair.
That's all right.
And like quite a lot has happened since then. So
did you have to tell the person what their object was worth?
No, I think we were just talking about like its historical importance. There was something about a cabaret singer who'd been really like big back in the day, but I can't remember what the object was. I'm sorry, this isn't a very good story.
No, it's very good. I like it when people are bamboozled by their own life. That's what I enjoy. Now, it's a kind of joke I do at the beginning. I pick on something obscure. It's all right. There's lots to talk to you about. I'm going to try and keep it light for a bit. For a little bit. What did I have that was light? Oh, it was the Antiques Roadshow. That was
That's your lot.
That was a lot. So, look, let's talk about you. You grew up in Ireland. You weren't born in Ireland, but you grew up in Ireland.
No, I was born in Ireland. Yeah.
Went away.
I was born in Ireland, went away, came back.
Right.
And, yeah, I was raised there.
Cool. So,
City.
And that's... As a half Nigerian, half Irish person, you'd sort of talked about how there weren't any other black people at all in Ireland, really, at that time.
Yeah. If I saw another black person, that would be like something of an event.
Yeah.
It was, unusual. It was like a 99.9% white country.
Yeah.
So just very little difference in any way, you know. Like if someone even had a surname that wasn't an Irish surname, like that stood out, you know. So yeah. Actually, being black was a big deal.
And do you feel the Ireland's changed a lot, right, in the last few decades?
Yeah, like, it really has.
Whilst I think England, especially, has gone quite a long way in the other direction.
You could say.
Yeah. And so obviously, it was not necessarily a pleasant experience, but do you feel that as a writer and as an academic, do you feel having that sense of growing up somewhere where you, you know, were different than everyone else was a positive thing for you in some ways? If you ignore all the horrible racism that you're getting.
No, I think like alterity. Oh God, I'm so tired. I cannot speak. This is going to be a fun evening. I think like being like an outsider and kind of like observing stuff maybe from the margins can give you like an interesting perspective. Yeah. And I also just feel I was having lunch with somebody else who was Irish today, who had left at a similar age to me and been in the UK for a similar amount of time. And we were both talking about how when we were growing up there, and hers was nothing to do with race, but like I was saying, anything that was in any way different, you know, it was a very, very socially conservative country until very recently. So anyone that was like in any way different kind of was going to leave. We were talking about that, but we were talking about how looking back, there are so many things that we're grateful for having grown up there. Like, I think my perspective is very Irish, my worldview, my sense of humor. So with hindsight, I'm great. Yeah, I'm glad that I'm Irish Emma rather than like American Emma, because I could have been if I'd stayed in the States. So I didn't necessarily think that at the time, but yeah, in hindsight, it was, yeah.
Because we had a comedian called Phil Wang on a few weeks ago, who's half Malaysian and half English. And mm-hmm. He's written a book called Sidesplitter, which is excellent, about sort of not feeling that he's both feeling that you're both of those things, but neither of those things. Mm-hmm. So in Malaysia, he's too white, and in England, he's too Asian. And so he's sort of like an outsider, mm-hmm. but also it gives you a perspective. I think as a comedian, especially, it gives you a sort of perspective on both the cultures.
Yeah, I think as a comedian, as a writer, I think there's a lot of professions actually where it gives you like a particular insight and perspective that can be rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel? Does it? I mean, because it's interesting with obviously if you're half of two things. Do you feel that same as Phil? Do you feel like not Irish in Ireland? And
no, like to be honest, I wouldn't describe myself as half Irish or half Nigerian. I would say that I'm Irish and Nigerian, you know? I don't think that you have to. Yeah, I don't really buy into that whole like system of categorizing people, like, you know, into kind of like quotients like that. So I would say like I'm an Irish woman, not half Irish. Or sometimes people would be like, oh my God, you're really like in touch with your Irish side. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like I'm Irish, you know? Irish people don't really say that. It's usually English people. They're like, oh yeah, you're really in touch with your Irish side. I'm like, yeah, because I'm Irish. So anyway.
But it's, you know, it has changed so much. I saw the documentary about, now I'm terrible with football, but the manager Charlton. Was it the manager of Ireland, Jackie Charlton, who was a big fan of Paul McGrath, who's the
Paul McGrath. Yeah, we don't pronounce the TH. Okay.
Who was a got everything wrong so far. Everything wrong. I wanted to say Paul McGrath as well. I thought no, McGrath. It's Paul McGrath in this. I think. Do you think his story? It's sort of he had an awful childhood and had quite a lot of repercussions into his adult life. But the people of Ireland really took him to heart after the success of the Irish football team. Mm-hmm. And do you think that was a big turning point for Ireland?
No, I don't think Paul McGrath was a big turning point for Ireland. Actually, I'm a bit traumatised by Paul McGrath, because when I was growing up, they'd be like, is that your dad? Like, that's my association with Paul McGrath, or being called Pauline McGrath. So, I don't think he was the turning point.
No.
But I think like that's the thing that happens, you know, if somebody... It's changed now, because there is like a black and brown kind of like Irish identities emerging and communities and stuff in the way that there certainly wasn't in my time or in Mr. McGrath's. But I think when somebody, you know, had shown themselves to be like exceptional in the manner that he had, then there's like kind of a claiming. But I would imagine that when he was growing up, he was probably rejected, because I was kind of told, I was always told, you know, you're not really Irish. So I would imagine it was similar for him.
Yeah. No? Okay. Well, look.
I really didn't expect us to be talking about Paul McGrath.
There'll be a lot of stuff you're not expecting. There'll be a lot of stuff you're not expecting. Yeah. Believe me, it's going to go a long way from this phrase. Your first book, which I have not read, but I've read about.
That's totally grand.
Because it didn't. I ordered it from Amazon and it didn't turn up. And Miriam Margolyes' book is about 4,000 words, pages long. So that was about people touching your hair or not wanting people to touch your hair.
So the book isn't about people not touching my hair.
That's what it is.
But the title references that social phenomenon.
Sure.
But I guess it's kind of a, it's quite a, you know, straightforward, kind of simplistic title. The book is about, like, it's about a lot more than just the phenomenon of unsolicited hair touching of black people. I mean, there's a chapter. So what I wanted to do was show, there was starting to be this conversation about black hair kind of entering the mainstream. In black communities and, like, black cultures, hair is... you know, something that just, like, a lot of creative energy is poured into, and hair is kind of like a big deal. But I think people outside wouldn't really know that. But that was starting to become kind of something that was entering into mainstream conversations. And then there was, like, a backlash against that, being like, oh my God, they're just banging on about hair. Like, it's only hair, you know, it's not a big deal. So I wanted to write something that demonstrated, like, why black hair matters, like, why it is important. So just going into the kind of social history of black hair and ways in which, you know, you can actually see a lot that is going on in terms of where we're at in terms of kind of race relations and stuff based on people's hairstyles. You can see histories of, like, resistance and assimilation, and all of these politics are expressed through hair and the way hair is policed and the way hair is worn and stuff. So it's like a history book that goes from pre-colonial Africa through, like, slavery, the Harlem Renaissance, into today and the future, and kind of Afrofuturistic. So it's cyclical in time and all of that good stuff. So, yeah, it's not just about hair.
No. Good. Because I've got Chinese hair.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know...
I don't fully understand what that means, well, but...
I went to a Thai barber and he told me I had Asian hair.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know...
I mean, you have lovely hair.
Yeah, so I know a lot about what you're talking about. That's awesome. Mainly my life has been not much prejudice, but whenever my hair is seen, people are very prejudiced.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, so I know a lot you're talking about.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It's all right. But in that book, you talk about... it is sort of interesting... the way that Beyonce and Lauryn Hill are treated very differently, and one chose to westernize her hair and one chose to not westernize her hair. Is that...
I mean, I don't think it's just the hair. I think, like, Lauryn Hill was somebody that had quite... like, her politics and her whole output was very different to Beyonce's. I think they're just very different artists. It's probably no coincidence that one of the ways that difference is expressed is through their hair. You know, Lauren having locks and Beyonce having that.
But then the attitudes of people towards those two artists as well. Did you think that she's, Lauryn Hill seems more militant?
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially in those days, you know, but I don't think she's seen as more militant because of her hair. But I think her militancy is also expressed through her choice of hairstyle, you know, as opposed to, in contrast to Beyoncé's bouffant.
This is the quote that I wanted to, this is what I was looking for earlier. Until the late 1990s, being black and Irish in Ireland was to almost unicorn standards, except everybody loves unicorns.
Yeah.
Very good quote.
Thanks.
And so the new book, which you wrote during lockdown, What White People Can Do Next.
Mm-hmm. it is a provocative title.
It is. Well, I wrote a book during
lockdown. To elicit such reactions.
I wrote a book called in lockdown called The Problem with Men, and the same thing happens is that people read the title and decide. But then that's a deliberate choice to make the title provocative so that people are then, you know, hopefully rather than going, oh, no, you can't tell me what to do next. I'm going to tell you that they'll read the book and find it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there was a lot of that reaction. I had a lot of, like, really irate people who are racialized as white message me and say, how dare you write a book telling me what to do? I'm not taking instructions from a black person. And
that's not like white people, is it? Very surprised.
But, you know, within 3 or 4 pages, I have identified why it's actually, like, a really problematic title, you know, and how I actually see, like, I'm not just talking about anti-racism, I'm actually trying to challenge the whole concept of race and looking at these generic categories like white and black and saying it is actually preposterous for me to write this missive to white people. Like, who am I addressing, you know? So I'm kind of looking at the language and the framing of current anti-racist discourse and critiquing it.
Yeah. And it's interesting that white people...
Of a lot of it, not all of it, but yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot... It's a short book, but there's a lot packed in there, and it's quite hard to unpack it all, I think. There's a lot of things...
Oh, no, I'm really sorry to hear that, because to be kind of like a crash course.
No, but it's good, because it makes you think a lot, but there's stuff that I've read it twice, so does that make up for not reading the first one? there's still... But, I'd not thought about the idea that... for both white and black people, but to categorise white people and say you're all in a gang, and whether you're from Russia or Finland or wherever, you're all the same group. You wouldn't take that, you know, for any other kind of. It is odd to be categorised as a in white and black people.
And black is the same. There's huge diversity that exists amongst people who are racialised as black. You know, there's lots of different cultures, lots of different conditions and ideas. Yeah, it's just that huge diversity in these generic categories that were invented in the 17th century.
Yeah, so the book argues that it was in 1611 or something like that, the idea
1661.
Okay, the idea of black and white was created.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, people are going to go... Well, there were black and white people before then.
There weren't. That's what I say in the book. I'm just like, in the history of humankind, white people are babies. They've only existed since 1661, but so have black people, you know? So obviously there have always been differences in complexion and hair texture and all of those things that we now understand as race, racialized difference. But the idea that those things had any intrinsic value didn't exist until the invention of the idea of a white race and a black race.
Yeah.
And it was created the first time we see a reference. So these concepts that we have of ourselves as white people or black people that are presented as, you know, just the natural order of things, you know, they're just consistent categories that happen to exist, are really relatively recent ways of us understanding ourselves and each other. And they were the concept of a white race as we understand it now was first introduced in the English colony of Barbados in 1661, codified into law through these slave codes. And the reason it was created at that time in that place is various things were going on, but one of the reasons was to enshrine this notion of superiority in the group who came to be known as white people, to justify the enslavement of the group who came to be known as black people. All of the kidnapped Africans that were in Barbados and in the Americas, whose labor the colonies were becoming increasingly reliant on. The economies of the colonies were becoming increasingly reliant on. So to justify that kind of brutal system of exploitation, the idea of a white race that was innately superior and were the natural kind of lords and masters of this black race. And that's when blackness started to be associated with all of these negative characteristics and white people with all of these virtuous and positive ones. It was to justify that system. But another reason that it happened in that moment in Barbados was because, and I think this is really interesting, the Europeans that were in the colony had no sense of themselves as white people or having kind of a shared identity as white until the idea was introduced, and it really caught on. But there was everyone, like, in terms of Europeans that were there were like indentured Irish, there were English landlords, Scottish landlords. There were all of these different classes of European people from different countries as well who had no sense of a shared identity. These laws were introduced after there had been a number of uprisings where enslaved Africans and indentured Irish had come together to attack the English and Scottish landlords who they saw as a common enemy. They're like, they're both exploiting our labor. And this was really like threatening to the status quo because there were more of those people if they all came together. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the idea of whiteness did was to shut down those coalitions emerging between like white workers, the people who came to be known as white workers and enslaved Africans, because it introduced this kind of immutable difference between them and this notion of, you know, the superiority of one and the inferiority of the other. So it was actually also to prevent these kind of cross-racial coalitions from emerging.
Sure. And that's, you know, that's stayed with us ever since, really. So I mean, weirdly enough, in my book as well, which does touch on All Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter and all that nonsense, the All Lives Matter bit, as well as the sexism and stuff. But it is... The men who sort of, in my book's about the men who go, when's International Men's Day, when there's an International Women's Day. And yet, my conclusion was not exactly the same as yours, but in that actually the system is weighted against those guys, not because of women, but because of the ruling elite who are the ones who send them to war. And all the men go, well, this is bad for men, this is bad for men, this is bad for men. And the reason those things are bad for men is because they're the people in charge.
Exactly.
And they've bought into that idea of men. And this is the same thing with buying into the idea of whiteness, feeling a superiority to other people and then feeling threatened by those people because you've been told to, whereas the real enemy is the people with all the money.
Yeah. And people are distracted from identifying that because their focus is on the wrong people, you know, who they've been kind of conditioned and manipulated to see as their enemy, even though they might have a lot in common.
Yeah. So you're talking about the idea of a coalition of people understanding that and coming together rather than being sort of forced apart.
Well, I just think I think in this moment when, you know, race is kind of so high on the agenda and there are so many conversations about racism and anti-racism, I think it's really important to have a familiarity with that history and to know that race was invented to justify racism and to enshrine this kind of hierarchy of races. I just think that is history that is kind of, yeah, crucial for us to know. And it's not very well known at all. Like most people are quite surprised when they're...
Absolutely, because I think in the UK especially, we're not taught that, which, you know, again, is... When will it be White History Month? It's the same thing. We're not taught the reason there's a Black History Month is because we don't know any of this stuff. And increasingly we're sort of being told to, you know, be proud of the colony, you know, of the British Empire and
but
all this
stuff.
But the stuff
I'm talking about is English history.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know why choose not to teach that part.
I did history at university and I didn't know. You know, looking back at it, I didn't really do any work anyway. But that's irrelevant. I did something about slavery and emancipation in America.
That was
my special subject.
Outsourced. Yeah. Yeah.
And I only did that because I couldn't speak any languages, so I had to do something in America, and that was what I was offered. But you know, so it's not something that was covered at all. You know. So it is interesting that the book is seems you're saying, you know, there shouldn't be white guilt and you don't like the idea of checking your privilege and all that sort of stuff. And yet it half seems that, and it half seems like you're really calling for the whole of society to be destroyed and start again. I don't know.
I don't know.
But there's that great analogy. There's the analogy you quote about a slave ship, and you've got the slaves chained up underneath, and the guys, the white guys above, taking the ship. And the answer isn't to let a few of the slaves up to be on the upper decks with the other guys. The answer is to get rid of the ship.
Yeah.
But isn't that what you're saying about society, therefore, if that's the...
Well, I mean, the beauty of art is interpretation. So, yeah, that's...
because if you know, the capital... You talk about capitalism, and capitalism has to change. But if capitalism changes, it's not just about saying, well, let's make it fair so that the best people get to have the money and everyone else does the work. Yeah, it has to be. Otherwise, it's just creating a different underclass of people. So, well, presumably you don't want that.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like, you know, so in the book I have a section that is called Interrogate Capitalism. And it's just looking at the kind of origins of the system of global capitalism that we live under now, and how its origins are at the same time that race is being invented in these English and European colonies, and how the system of that global financial system is intimately linked to the creation of race in that historical moment. And so the relationship, I say, race and capitalism are siblings, you know. And then I also kind of link all of it to our current environmental crisis. Yeah. And it's that type of, that exploitation of human labor, and that exploitation of the earth's resources, and the pursuit, you know, of just constant growth and profit has not only brought us to this crisis around race, but has also brought us to this moment of environmental crisis. And so those two things are also kind of like intimately intertwined. And the current system is just not sustainable, no. You know, by any calculation. So we can only continue as we are going in this direction for a finite amount of time, because literally, like, the earth can't sustain it.
Yeah.
You know, but we just kind of ignore that.
So you're calling for the overthrow of our society.
No, because the chapter's not called Overthrow. It's called Interrogate Capitalism. But, just like, think about these things.
Yeah,
you know?
think about it and then overthrow. I mean, I agree with it. I think it's... But it does, you know, it is absolutely... It's sort of... When you think about the damage done to the world by European... It's European people... So let's just call them all white people. We've fucked up the world, right? We create this awful situation. I hope people will be able to look back at our time and laugh at how ridiculous and awful it is. But you look back 300 years and you think, how did people like put people in slave ships and take them across an ocean? How did they morally do that? How were they able to live with themselves after doing that? And they were able to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they came up with some reason for doing that. The irony, I mean, you're talking about a lot of the slaves worked on tobacco places, and then they're making tobacco, which then killed all the white people smoking the tobacco. So it's like, it's creating these awful situations for everyone, yeah, where everyone loses, and then they destroy the world.
Yeah, and that's it, in a nutshell.
Yeah, but, you know, I, that's what I feel with the, you know, with my book, is that the feeling of these people propping up these systems, that if they thought about it, you know, the answer is to change society very quickly, surely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the emphasis needs to be on that, rather than, you know, this current kind of almost fetishization of interpersonal privilege. Like, the type of change that needs to happen with something of a degree of urgency is not going to happen on that interpersonal level. So all of the emphasis on check your privilege and all that is actually, I think, quite distracting, you know?
Yeah.
I think our attention is in the wrong place. And in the book, like I say, you can't just jump to coalition. Like, I think there needs to be like an honest. So one of the other chapters, I think one of the first chapters is like stop the denial. So I think there needs to be an understanding of the fact that when the idea of white people is invented, it is invented to enshrine this notion of inherent superiority. So we shouldn't be surprised when racist things happen. Race was invented to justify racism. So we need to have that as our starting point. We need to understand that. But then we need to move on from that. And I think rooting everything in this, as I said, this kind of interpersonal privilege level is not very strategic and won't bring about what needs to happen.
Well, it feels like check your privilege when you see that. It's more like you're not allowed to comment on this. It seems a way of shutting someone out of a conversation. As much as I understand why it's there, and I've had it, I think it's good for people to understand the way they're privileged if they're not looking at it that way. Yeah. But just to say, check your privilege is sort of a shutdown. You do talk about social media being sort of not helpful, really, in this, that it's a way of saying something and not doing anything.
Yeah, so I think social media has been like really powerful and helpful in like the global response, you know, that happened, that we saw after the murder of George Floyd. And all of the changes that seem to be subsequently happening. Like, I think social media was really, really powerful in bringing us to that point. Like, I don't think people would have paid as much attention if it hadn't been for the power of social media. But I just feel that when these conversations about race happen only on social media and people are getting all of their learning about it from social media, it tends to be quite reductive and polarizing. And these platforms are not just neutral platforms where people are just, you know, kind of exchanging information, but they're spaces where, you know, outrage and division is incentivized. So when you are having all these conversations about something like race happening in a landscape where division is incentivized, that is potentially like pretty disastrous. So I think social media can be like a powerful tool for bringing your attention to issues that you didn't, that creating kind of awareness of issues that people really didn't, might not have known about. But I think their understanding of those issues has to go beyond the information that they see or find on social media. You know, people have to kind of read more further
and just be seen to say the right thing rather than than act upon it. So, you know, there's an element of that in, it's not just social media, in life there is the kind of people who just want to say the right thing
and
never going to do anything.
So that's one of the things that I say about guilt. You know, I'm saying guilt is not a generative emotion. I feel like guilt paralyzes people. But also, if people are operating from a position where they're just trying to make themselves feel less guilty, and it's about them in that way, I think the actions that stem from that motivation, I think are just likely to be performative, piecemeal, and inadequate. But if you're motivated from knowing that you are also in certain ways oppressed or exploited by the system that we live under, and you're actually acting more out of self-interest rather than out of, I feel guilty and I need to kind of do something about that, or I need to not be called out or whatever, you know, kind of fear of being called out. I think the action taken will be very different. Like, yeah, so I don't think guilt is particularly helpful.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Now, I hope the book would just tell me what to do next. And there's a lot of work. You told me to read books and stuff. I wasn't expecting that.
I also encourage dancing.
Maybe. Yeah, dancing as well. Here's a specific example. And what should I do in this situation? I live in a small village in Hertfordshire now. And there's a guy who walks his dogs, who I just nod at every now and again. We say hello when we pass each other. And then I passed him one day and he was wearing an All Lives Matter T-shirt. And, you know...
Oh, God.
Should I say anything to... No, I didn't say, mate, just Black Lives Matter means the same as that.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter, clever. Yeah. We live in a village where there are some black people. There aren't very many black people. There aren't many ethnic people, but there are some. And you're thinking, this guy's walking around with that T-shirt. Is it wrong for me to wimp out of I mean, I've mentioned on a podcast now, so you might listen to... Is it wrong for me to wimp out and not go, mate, don't wear that around. It's embarrassing.
So if you just say to him, don't wear that, like, that's probably not going to be that effective. No. And he'll probably get really defensive. Yeah. And he's almost probably trying to... It's quite provocative, him wearing that.
It is.
So he probably almost wants somebody to say that. But maybe... And this is where I feel like you would have more energy to do this, perhaps, than a person who's racialized as black or some other racialized group. Because when you're kind of having those confrontations regularly and it's literally about your life, that's weighted quite differently than it would be for you. So you should have the energy to have like a conversation, I feel, with him, just to kind of like probe. And I think in a dialogue, maybe you could be more effective in shifting his opinion than just saying you shouldn't be wearing that.
Yeah,
you know,
I could give him a copy of my book, which is about that. But it's weird that I don't, that I, you know, that that's where you feel like, ah, so like I've written something, but I'm not prepared to, you know, because it's exactly that. I feel you're right. I feel if I said
written something, you have all the resources to probably be quite convincing and compelling to him in conversation.
I think
so.
You
should try that.
I would just call him a prick pretty quickly.
And I mean, you're totally entitled to do that, and he probably is a prick, right? But like, I guess it just depends what outcomes we want, you know?
I mean, I think almost certainly he thinks he's making a point of, hey, look, you know, we should care about everyone. That's what he thinks. So in his head,
yeah.
He thinks he's being a bit of a prick, but he thinks he's making a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sad. All right. So if he wears it again, he's in trouble. Can I ring you and get you to talk to him if I...
No. It's your job.
That is my job.
Hand him my book.
I'll hand him your book. I'll hand him my book. Let's get rid of some of my books. Got a big load of them in the back of my house. Need to get rid of them. All right, I'm going to ask you an emergency question. And it's... Why are white people the best? No, it's not. It's,
oh, my God.
Let's see what comes up. Oh, these are by my daughter. My daughter wrote some of these.
Okay.
Would you rather be the floor or the sky? That is from my...
Definitely the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an easy one. Not like the questions you were asking me backstage. I was like, what?
This is another from my daughter. I haven't paid her for this. What would you rather find at the end of the universe, Candyland or Pink, Purple and Pinky Purple Land?
Pinky Purple Land. Yeah.
Everything's pink or purple.
In Candyland, is everything candy?
Everything's made of sweets.
No, I can't deal with that. I'd have to go pink. Yeah, pink, purple.
Those are childish questions.
Is the next one going to be more sophisticated?
It is. Would you rather find a magical land by walking through the back of your wardrobe or by being caught up in a tornado?
Definitely the wardrobe option.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I watched The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe with my kids yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
stupid, isn't
it? It's a classic.
There's loads of talking animals in it and stuff. Doesn't make any sense.
Ridiculous.
I didn't find out who wins in the end. It's a Christian allegory, you know?
Yeah. Aslan is God.
He's Satan.
Aslan.
Aslan is Satan. He just eats all the kids in the end.
The alternative.
If you get to the last, book. So the guilt thing is quite interesting because there is, you know, I do feel, like I was talking about reading this book about fantastic women with my daughter, and just like I feel, my daughter actually said what I said in the past, women weren't, you know, people thought women should be educated. She went, what, so they didn't go to school? And I said, yes, that's brilliant. You just stay at home. So I don't think she got the right. But it's sort of that, I do, you know, I feel embarrassed just reading that book about women. And I do feel like, you know, I just feel, well, all the stuff that's happened with the Colston statue, which is from Bristol, near where I grew up. And, you know, people, obviously it's wrong to pull down statues without asking permission. But
shocking badness.
So I feel very guilty about that. No, I feel, you know, it is amazing when you look at the history of Britain and UK, how much of the society is built. Liverpool and Bristol built on
slippery
slavery.
With the blood of slaves.
And so, how do we make up? I mean, I know it's not our fault, but as you say in the book, it's how we act with that. How do you feel we should act in the modern day with the money that people are? I mean, there are rich people who I guess are still rich off of that money that was made in those.
And often people who were powerful then, and their power was, you know, kind of consolidated or certainly enhanced, you know, through the slave trade. A lot of their descendants are still powerful today, you know.
Yeah.
So I think at the most basic level, there just needs to be like a truthful reckoning, like with the history of Britain, you know. Like I think that is like the most basic thing that needs to happen. And it's not about like people are like, oh, you can't make me feel guilty for da, da, da. And I'm just like, yeah, but you don't have to feel guilty for something that your ancestors did, you know, but you have to take responsibility for what you do.
Yeah.
You know, we've all been born into this system. We've all inherited this system and the architecture of race. These are decisions that were made, like, you know, centuries before we were born. But we don't have to just blindly continue to reproduce it. You know, we can actually make things. Oh my God, I should have turned my phone off. That's very unprofessional. I think it's my mum as well. She's kind of stalking me. Sorry, mum. I think I just turned the ringer on. Shit. I'm a little delirious. I didn't have very much sleep last night. I've got young children. And
I understand. Yeah. We're both the same. We're both in a fantasy. This probably isn't happening.
We've gone through the back of the wardrobe.
We might have done.
I think there just needs to be... I don't think, like, Britain has had an honest reckoning with the truth of, you know, empire and imperialism, and the way that has shaped the identity and the culture of the country. And again, it's not about, like, you know, haranguing people, but it's just about being honest about the history and how. And, you know, then people will be like, oh, but why are you banging on about something that happened like 200 years ago? And I'm like, well, because it completely shapes the present. Like, it's the reason why things are the way they are. It's the reason why we're having these conversations. So yeah, there just needs to be that honest engagement.
And what do you feel? I know you sort of say in the book you don't think that it's helpful to talk about an end game, but are we ideally getting to a world where race isn't a factor, or are we ideally getting to a world where, you know, everyone is appreciative of their own cultures? And
yeah,
I mean, because I did a routine about how, you know, in a way racists are more liberal than liberals because they see the world as four kinds of people. And some of them only see it as two kinds of people, so they're very close to seeing everyone is exactly the same. They just need to make one more step, whereas the rest of us is 195 different peoples and we're a long way away. But are we aiming for a world where race is just seen the same as hair colour or eye colour or height or whatever?
I mean, like, difference will always exist, and difference is like a beautiful and wonderful thing, you know, like the kind of diversity that exists in the world is phenomenal. And it's not about creating some sort of like homogenized, standardized. Well, I mean, that is kind of what does happen, but yeah, that is not the aim. But when I think it's just important that we know that this architecture of race that we see as a foundational principle and the only way of viewing the world is just a relatively recent phenomenon. It's not something that just naturally occurs, just happens to be in nature. And it was invented to create and enshrine racism.
Yeah.
I don't know necessarily, like, I don't have a prescriptive that this is what we do when we know that. But I think if everybody really understood that, that would be at least, you know, a starting point.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it is true that people don't, you know, people go, oh, well, you know, it's in us innately that if people look different, they're not from our tribe and we must fight them. But everyone seems to get on with, except with gingerhead people. They all seem to get on with, you know, those sort of differences.
Apparently people with ginger hair actually have like really poor outcomes on lots of markers. Somebody was telling me that recently, like they actually, I don't know.
Well, I mean,
they deserve
it though. That's the thing. So that is, that's the difference. It's okay. Come on, we've got to be allowed to be racist towards one lot of people. And it's just the ginger. If we move on to the gingers,
what does my book say? Stop the false equivalencies. Come on, we know gingers aren't a race. Not racially. There was something I wanted to say and I've forgotten. But I think we at least need to know about the fictitious nature of race. And it's not to say that racism doesn't exist, because then some people try and take it to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Racism is real and present, but race was created to create it. And actually, that's what I was thinking. You know, when people are like, oh, well, racism, it's just human nature. There's been racism for millennia.
Yeah.
That is objectively untrue. Like, that's just not true. There's always been prejudice, you know, but it actually being racism is really, really a new, in the kind of scope of human history, it's a new phenomenon.
Right. And I mean, in some ways, the United Kingdom seems better about this than when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I was as racist as, not as anyone, I wasn't as racist as Hitler. I was as racist. I was racist as a kid. Mm-hmm. I would think, just because, I mean, you talk about it in your book, but there were nursery rhymes with the N-word in them.
Mm-hmm.
That we were taught. So you were taught certain things. All TV, the TV shows of the 1970s was all, what if a black fella moves in next door to you? That was the sort of main joke. And do you feel that England? I mean, it's mainly England I'm talking about, because I think the rest of the United Kingdom has done a lot better. No, maybe not Northern Ireland, but do you feel we've progressed? Because, you know, that sort of stuff wouldn't be on TV anymore, and kids growing up wouldn't be just innately taught to be racist, would some, but not to that degree.
Yeah, no, I think there has definitely been change, and that kind of like explicit racism is not as present in the way in the way that it was that you're describing. But racism is actually like quite sophisticated, and like it morphs and it adapts. So even though there's not necessarily that level of explicit stuff, I don't think that means that that doesn't mean that we've kind of like solved the problem and that it's gone away. But certainly there has been change. Yeah. But I quote James Baldwin quite a lot in the book because I'm a big fan of his writing. And even though he's writing in the 1950s and the 1960s, I just think he's, you know, even for now, his writing seems, you know, kind of streets ahead of lots of other like more contemporary voices. But he's talking about, he says all European people have, there's a deadly temptation to feel an innate superiority. So there's a... Do you want to elaborate? So there's a deadly temptation to feel an innate superiority. And I think that is something that, yeah, just has to be like engaged with, you know? But whiteness was created to create that sense of an innate superiority, you know? So that's there in the DNA of the racial classification and the racial category.
And I'd sort of felt like racists would die out, you know, the racists are old, so therefore racism would die with old people. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be happening.
No, I don't think there's any I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that I think that sometimes I feel this generation, this division of people in terms of generation is actually, again, maybe like a bit misleading. I don't even know if it's like empirically correct, but right. I think there's lots of older people who probably like aren't really racist and lots of younger people who probably are really racist, you know? I don't think it's necessarily determined by your generation.
No.
It might show up differently, you know, the way you... The racism might show up differently based on your generation, but I don't think it's fully determined just by your age.
No. And, you know, I sort of feel sorry for the, you know, in a way, I feel sorry for those guys. And I write about them in my book, the guys who were sort of furiously protecting the statue of Winston Churchill and sort of got so confused they were punching each other and the police because nobody had turned up to... And they're so angry, you know, they're so angry. And yet all of their problems come from within, you know, from them not knowing who their real enemy is.
Yeah. If only their anger could be more effectively directed, you know, in some way that might bring them some sense of peace and, like, fulfilment.
Yeah. But, you know, is that sort of feeling of... I mean, it's sort of been proven wrong, hasn't it? Because they've sent home everybody who came to the country to work for us, and they've discovered nobody in England wants to take those jobs.
Yeah.
So there weren't people coming over and taking their jobs. They'll accept, I think it's very hard to change minds because it's very hard to change people's minds when they've got that committed to their point of view, to that degree that they won't even listen to an argument. So they're the guys you have to convince for sexism, for racism. Those guys, and it's those particular guys in Trafalgar Square, they're both sexist and racist and angry with themselves and want to punch someone because they're because they're lost. They are, I understand, I get it. They feel lost and they feel emasculated by their own definition of what a man is. They feel like the world's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And they need as much help as anyone, really.
Sometimes I think, I don't actually know, I'm not familiar with this group of men, sadly.
I think you are.
But no, this particular incident. I have a kind of vague awareness of it. But I think that there are kind of like fringe extremists that, you know, it's not even really about them. Like there's people that... it probably would just be completely like wasted energy and effort. Like they're too far gone. But I would imagine that those people are more, are a minority. And I think there's a lot of other people who are more like, who could be more easily persuaded in certain ways, but they actually become alienated and then are more susceptible to going that way, you know? But I think it's about kind of persuasive arguments. Yeah. And I think there are people that... I think there's a kind of mass of people that are kind of probably more open to being easily persuaded.
I think so. I mean, I'm a sort of hopeful, but I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why. It feels like the world hasn't got much of a chance because of the environment and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sort of hopeful that things will... It just feels like, you know, when you look back at Victorian times, people go, oh, they put kids up chimneys and they did this. What a load of idiots. And no one then... It's the same thing I was talking about. You're not prepared to turn that focus onto yourself.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Think, imagine what... I mean, I just hope in 100 years' time that people would look back and go, why the hell did people have this big issue about just, the colour of someone's skin? It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, but even like our reliance on things like coltan, you know, in our phones, in all of the devices that we are so... that we are so like addicted to and so reliant on. Like, I actually think, you know, when people are like, oh, I never would have used like slave produced products. And I'm like you totally would have if it was normalized, because you'll use coal, you'll use these minerals that are mined by children in like horrific conditions and not really think twice about it, or wear clothes that are like, you know, made by sweatshop laborers. So yeah, most people probably will go along with like appalling things if they're normalized, and they'll just kind of compartmentalize it and justify it to themselves in some way.
Yes, that's sad, isn't it? what are you gonna do next, Emma?
Well, I'm not a white person, so I don't need to do anything.
can I tell I don't think I should be able to tell. Because you're finishing, this is your PhD as well, right? This
isn't my PhD. This was just like a little cute side project in lockdown. I'm actually in the final year of my PhD. Yeah. So I'm just gonna finish that off.
And then do you want to move? I mean, you're a fantastic writer and thinker.
Thank you.
Are you going to? Is it irritating that I've just talked to you for an hour about? I mean, about your book, to be fair. You started it. It annoys me that I have to have this like a conversation with you. You know what I mean? Whereas if you were a white author, I would talk to you about other stuff. Are you keen to write about other stuff?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I intend to write more, and the next book that I'm planning will not be non-fiction. It will be fiction.
Okay.
But yeah, it won't have race as like kind of... I often feel like I didn't want to write anything on allyship. I didn't even really want to contribute to the allyship conversation. I felt like provoked by everything that I was seeing, sure. by what was happening around me. And I was like, no, there needs to be an intervention. Like, I actually felt like a duty of service to write that. But yeah, there are many, many other things that interests me and that I would like to be, you know, thinking and writing about as well.
And Antiques Roadshow, would you go back?
Of course.
But you're going to, I mean, you're as well as being a great writer, you're an extremely glamorous person. So I'm sure TV is knocking down your door to... I mean, if you're not watching the video of this, the outfit is absolutely phenomenal. So I'm sure that there's... That's a pot... Do you miss the days when academics were really disgustingly ugly? And do you miss those days? I miss those days.
I don't know that we live in a time where academics are like renowned for their glamour.
The ones you're allowed to see are all good looking now. They hide away. That's what your next book should be about.
Okay.
Bring out the ugly academics again. Get them out. Let them on the telly again. You used to watch Open University, and it just used to be. People who were barely like human. I mean, if they weren't speaking, you would think they were a different species.
Someone like Stuart Hall seemed quite suave and sophisticated. Well,
that's the only bad thing about you is you're too glamorous.
Well, do you know what? The coat, I didn't plan on wearing the coat on stage. I'm just having, first of all, I was a little bit cold. When I was backstage, I was like, oh, it's actually fucking freezing. So I was like, let me keep my coat on. I didn't realise it'd be so hot out here. But also I was having something of a wardrobe malfunction. So I was like, for the sake of decency, I'll keep the coat on. But now I'm actually quite uncomfortable and kind of sweating.
What animal died for that green fur you're wearing?
Oh my God, it's faux fur. No animals were harmed in the making of this coat.
No, I'm joking. Look, it's been really lovely to meet you.
Likewise.
I'm an awkward guy, aren't I? But, you know, I do the awkward thing at the beginning and then suddenly I get all perceptive, don't I, in the middle. I wish it was deliberate. I wish it was deliberate. I lull them into false insecurity and I got it. Right, that's my review. I'm just preempting the YouTube reviews of this. Which I'm, you know. Look forward to that. They don't know, guys who go on YouTube don't like women or people who aren't white. That's what I've noticed. So I've noticed that. But I just delete your comments, guys, if you put them down and block you. Look, I will look forward to whatever's coming next. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, Emma Dabbery.
You got it right, yes.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Emma Dabbery. Thank you to Scant Regard for playing the music on these titles. I am indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I am also indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and everyone at Go Past the Stripe. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for looking after us so brilliantly. Thank you to Ben Walker for eating a big sandwich during these credits. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to GoFasterStripe.com/badges. Become a monthly badger. You'll help us make more podcasts and you'll get loads and loads of lovely extras, including a badge and a membership pack and a secret code and backstage interviews that you can't see anywhere else. See you soon!
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. RichardHerring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.